Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nick Neihardt of the Group Public Campaign, who discusses the effect of the Supreme Court ruling in the Citizens United case, which opened the floodgates of corporate spending in this year's congressional election. Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who examines the issues behind the now-stalled U.S.-brokered Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. And author and editor Ava Golinger, who investigates the forces behind the recent failed coup attempt in Ecuador. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
China swiftly rebuked the Nobel Committee in Oslo, Norway, for awarding their 2010 Peace Prize to Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo, who is currently serving an 11-year prison sentence for subversion. Liu was arrested for drafting Charter 08, a manifesto for human rights in China. Since the Nobel Peace Prize was announced on October 8th, China has put Liu's wife, Liu Xia, under house arrest and blocked her mobile and internet service. In addition, China has canceled several meetings with Norwegian officials on fisheries issues. Since finding out he won the award, Liu has dedicated the Peace Prize to the victims killed at the Tiananmen Square massacre on June 4, 1989. After the Peace Prize was announced, the United States, France, and Germany called for his release. China has denounced prize winner Liu as a criminal. Police arrested Liu prior to the December 2008 release date of Charter 08, a manifesto that Xiaobo helped to write, which called for extensive political reforms of the Chinese government. Only days before his sentence, Liu released a statement saying, "I have no enemies and no hatred, none for the police who monitored, arrested, or interrogated me, or the prosecutors who indicted me." A new study in the scientific journal Nature estimates the water security of almost 5 billion people is at risk across the globe from the effects of human activities on the world's rivers. The study is the first attempt to look at the combined impacts of human intervention on freshwater bodies, including dams and reservoirs, irrigation for agriculture, pollution, and loss of biodiversity. Peter McIntyre of the University of Michigan, one of the study's lead authors, expressed surprise at the threat level in the United States and Europe. The study also identified even great rivers like the Yangtze River in China, the Nile River in Africa, and the Ganges River in India suffering serious biodiversity and water security stress. The report also found globally 10 to 20,000 species of aquatic wildlife are facing extinction because of the impact of human activity on rivers. Three-term Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, a progressive who opposed the Patriot Act, pushed through campaign finance reform and opposed expanded military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, is fighting for his political life. Feingold is trailing his Republican Tea Party-backed opponent, Ron Johnson, in recent public opinion polls and relying on a large grassroots army of supporters to win re-election. At a recent rally in Madison, Wisconsin, Feingold turned up his populist message by attacking the power of corporate America and linking the abuses of military contractors, media conglomerates, and business lobbyists. In his 18 years in the Senate, Feingold has taken many principled stands and bucked the Clinton and Obama administrations. The Wisconsin Democrat has opposed free trade agreements and balked at deregulating the banking industry, including the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in the 1990s. During the current campaign, Feingold is actively backing the Obama stimulus package and the health care reform law. Yet, he's been critical of Obama's approach to financial reform as too friendly to Wall Street and opposed the nomination of Tim Geithner as Treasury Secretary. Feingold's opponent, Ron Johnson, is a plastics manufacturer who has pledged to pour millions of his own money into the race. He's attacked the Obama health care plan and is a climate skeptic, saying global warming is caused by sunspots. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
In the final stretch of this year's congressional election campaign, the flood of corporate money being spent on attack advertising, targeting mostly Democrats, has itself become a hot campaign issue. In recent stump speeches, President Obama has harshly criticized conservative special interest groups that solicit contributions from anonymous donors to spend on negative campaign ads. The president has specifically cited the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Crossroads GPS affiliated with Republican campaign strategists Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie. President Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, and other Democrats have expressed concern that foreign money is being used by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to fund their $75 million campaign budget, an accusation denied by the chamber. The charges stem from an investigation by the Think Progress website, run by the Center for American Progress, which asserts that the chamber pays for political attack ads out of its general account, which solicits foreign contributions. Rules governing campaign spending and disclosure were changed this year after the January 21st U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United case, which ruled that corporations and unions have the same rights as citizens to influence elections. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nick Neihardt, co-founder and president of the group Public Campaign, who discusses the effect the Citizens United case has had on this year's election and his advocacy of the Fair Elections Now bill that would limit the influence of big money in politics.
Before, corporations really could spend a lot of money through various conduits, but they couldn't do it quite as directly, and so there was sort of a yellow light, a go-slow light on the spending. And what the Supreme Court did with Citizens United was put a big, fat green light saying, you know what, you can go as fast as you can, spend as much money as you want, and the courts won't get in the way, and neither will Congress. So if Congress wanted to regulate the spending further to slow it down, as they had previously, the court said, no dice, you're not going to be able to do that. And as a result, not only is there a lot more independent money, mostly coming out against Democrats. One statistic I saw today is that the conservative independent expenditures aimed at defeating Democrats or electing Republicans are outnumbering the pro-Democratic expenditures by about 5-1, and that's a pretty big number there. The other thing about it is a lot of it now is undisclosed because the kinds of money that are being spent now weren't allowed to be able to be spent directly, and so they weren't disclosed, but now they can spend it directly, and they can keep quiet who's spending it. So it's not if the chamber spends money, you know that it has to be listed as the Chamber of Commerce, but what they don't have to tell you is where they got that money. So if some particular companies may not want to damage their brand, they can kick money over to the chamber, and the chamber can then spend that in key races and flood the airwaves with attack ads.
Well, of course, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was the target of an investigation by a group called Think Progress that claims that their pledge to spend $75 million in this election cycle is funded in part by foreign donations from outside the United States. This has become quite an issue in the election campaign. Certainly many Democrats who are the targets of these well-funded TV ad campaigns are trying to hit back, saying that it very well may be foreign money that's influencing U.S. elections.
Well, it could be, Scott. We just don't know. What we do know is the chamber solicits funds from companies abroad to be part of the United States Chamber of Commerce. In some countries, they have programs that bring in corporations that are, in some cases, state-owned in those countries to be part of the chamber's operation. And when they advertise the chamber and promote the chamber, they say, we can be your voice, your American advocates here at home when it comes to affecting policy. And certainly elections are a big part of the public policy process. Now, the chamber has said, oh, no, that money comes in, but we keep it separate. But the fact is that they draw out of the same pot of money for these ads that they get money into from U.S. corporations and foreign corporations. So, you know, you can trust them and say, well, they must keep it shuttled over to the side over here, and they just draw money from these other internal accounts. But A, it's hard to tell, and B, money is fungible. So if they pay the light bill and the rent bill with the foreign money, it frees other money up to pay for the political ads.
Now, there was an effort in Congress to, in some way, affect the ruling by the Supreme Court in the Citizens United case that would mandate that some of this money had to be disclosed, despite that ruling. I believe it passed the House, but was filibustered in the U.S. Senate, so it's dead.
Could you tell us
a little bit about that effort, if you would?
Yeah, that effort would have made the kinds of organizations that don't have to disclose where their money is coming from when they put that money in the political ads, it would have forced them to disclose where that money came from. And that would have been a good thing. And that bill did, as you said, pass the House. It failed in the Senate by one vote. They couldn't find a single Republican to support it, and they went back a couple times to try and have it passed, but the Republicans said basically no dice. I think that it may come up again next year, but I don't think it's going to come up again before the November elections. But I tell you one thing, it's not enough just to disclose. If someone's aiming a bazooka at you, knowing the make, model, and registration of the bazooka isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is to be able to stop the bazooka from firing at you or having the ability to fire back. And the Supreme Court has said, well, we can't limit people putting these attack ads on the air. But there's another way that gives ordinary people a big voice, and that's public financing, the Fair Elections Now Act, that would give ordinary people making small donations a much greater role in politics. And that's the other approach to deal with these big ads from outside forces. Make it a viable option for candidates to depend on small donations, and then those small donations would trigger money from a Fair Elections Fund so they'd have enough wherewithal to fight back against these ads, both their opponents and then these independent expenditures.
That was Nick Neihardt, co-founder and president of Public Campaign. Contact the group by calling area code 202-293-0222 or visit their website at publiccampaign.org. The latest round of direct peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians began just a month ago and are now on hold because Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu let a partial one-time nine-month building freeze in the occupied West Bank expire. Palestinians stated at the outset they would not continue negotiations unless the freeze is extended. President Obama has promised millions of dollars in additional aid and more security guarantees for Israel if it extends the freeze for just 1 month, but as yet that has not happened. Netanyahu's latest ploy is to demand that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state, something their negotiators have always refused to do, possibly hoping to pin the blame on them for the failure of the talks. He has also thrown his support behind a demand by his right-wing coalition partners to require non-Jews wishing to become Israeli citizens to sign a loyalty oath to Israel as a Jewish democratic state. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, about the current state of negotiations, the role of the U.S., and what may offer hope for a just solution to the long-term conflict.
Unfortunately, probably people who look back on this experiment will see this as a replay of the Clinton-sponsored peace process of the 1990s, just telescoped into a much shorter time. And, you know, that the core reason for what I expect to be the failure of this exercise will be the same, which is that the United States was unable / unwilling to act as a genuinely honest broker and caved in to Israel's negotiating position and made Israel's negotiating position its own, and as a result made the entire process a non-starter. What Netanyahu has done, it's being portrayed as a sop to his right flank in his cabinet as a way of getting his cabinet to endorse an extension of the moratorium on settlement building that was honored in the breach in the past year. It may be that, but it's also a hurdle that he knows the Palestinians cannot jump over, and thus a way to shift the blame onto the Palestinians if, as seems to be the case, these talks collapse. And this leaves the United States, the Obama administration, holding the bag and looking pretty silly since they came into office saying that a freeze on settlement building in the West Bank was an absolute precondition of getting meaningful peace talks started, and they caved in. And now they can't even get a partial temporary freeze on settlement building.
I'm sure you're aware that George W. Bush was probably the most popular U.S. president ever in Israel, and Obama is the most unpopular. Israelis feel like he's demanding all these things, but in reality, the package he offered Netanyahu to get him to extend the partial freeze for just even 30 days was extremely generous. What did he offer the Palestinians?
Well, they reportedly offered the Palestinians a pledge to endorsed the idea of a Palestinian state on all of the lands occupied by Israel in 1967. That would have been a significant statement on the part of the United States, since in recent years the United States has shown, I should say, considerable ambiguity on that point. They have ceased mentioning the idea that Israel needs to withdraw from all of the territories occupied in 1967.
Does that include East Jerusalem?
Jerusalem was not specified in the reports that I saw, but that would seem to be included in, you know, a Palestinian state to be based on the 67 line.
Hasn't that been proposed for years?
Well, it's totally new that that would be tied with a Palestinian state in explicit terms. Of course, these are only press reports. We don't know that the administration, what the actual wording would have been. There was no public wording. But if you remember that UN Resolution 242 was not just voted for, but drafted by the U.S. ambassador to the UN at the time of the LBJ administration, then this was a U.S. position, really, that Israel needed to withdraw from all of the territories occupied in 67 as a precondition of a just and comprehensive peace in the Arab-Israeli situation. In theory, yes, it would be a fairly significant restatement of a historical U.S. position from which the Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush administrations dramatically retreated.
Chris Tensing, do you think the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, holds any hope for influencing the peace process? It seems to be growing, however slowly.
It is gaining traction, yes, among activist communities who, you know, it must be stated, are small, tiny in many places. But that's where the energy is, that's for sure. There's more energy there than there is in the peace process industry trying to promote a two-state solution as classically envisioned. So it does seem to be the wave of the future in those terms. I think the more thoughtful proponents of BDS are quite honest and clear-headed about the fact that a BDS strategy is a very long-term strategy. The wallop that strategy would pack, which I think Israel understands very well, is that it would not be the sort of thing that boycotts would actually economically cripple the occupation or economically cripple Israel, certainly not. But the idea would be to delegitimize what Israel is doing in its policies toward the Palestinians to the extent that other countries would think twice about doing business with Israel. The idea would be to have this sort of secondary effect that you would isolate Israel economically, diplomatically, culturally, etc. For that process to take place would take, you know, a long time. And it's very important to remember, I think, that, you know, the comparison with apartheid in South Africa is tempting, there are many parallels that are accurate, but there are also many things that are very different. And one thing that is crucially different is that you did not have, in the 1980s, in Europe and the United States, a vocal Afrikaner pro-apartheid lobby, which was fighting back against the BDS movement trying to get rid of apartheid in South Africa. Whereas you do have, in the United States in particular, a very vocal, well-organized pro-Israel lobby. And another crucial difference, which should not be minimized, is that there was no sort of ambient demonization in political culture of South African blacks like there is an ambient demonization of Arabs and Muslims in Western culture because of the image of Arabs and Muslims as terrorists who hate the West and so on.
That was Chris Tensing, editor of the Middle East Report, a publication of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Contact their Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-223-3677 or visit their website at merip.org. On September 30th, elements within Ecuador's police force staged violent protests against government cutbacks on officers' salary and benefits. But what first appeared to be protests by disgruntled civil servants transformed into an attempted coup against President Rafael Correa. When the president went personally to meet with police at the capital city's main barracks, he was physically assaulted and tear-gassed, which prompted him to tear off his shirt and declare, "If you want to kill the president, here he is. Kill him if you want to. Kill him if you are brave enough." When police attacks on the president escalated, he and his bodyguards fled to the city hospital, where he was treated for injuries. Protesting police, who had also taken over barracks and airport runways in different parts of the country, blocked the president's exit until a special forces unit of Ecuador's military launched an army attack on the rebellious police officers and freed Correa. During the attempted coup, Correa's supporters, who had gathered in the streets, were attacked by police. When freed, the president addressed thousands gathered at the presidential palace and blamed former President Lucio Gutierrez and other political opponents for orchestrating the coup attempt. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Venezuelan-American attorney Ava Golinger, author of the book The Chavez Code, and editor-in-chief of the Venezuelan English-language weekly newspaper Correo del Orinoco Internacional. Golinger discusses the role played by U.S.-funded opposition groups in Ecuador's failed coup and the connections with other efforts to overthrow democratically elected governments in Honduras and Venezuela.
What happened in Ecuador September 30th, it was a Thursday morning, there was a police rebellion taking place in the streets in reaction to the misinterpretation of a law that had been passed by the legislature the previous day. And the law was actually a restructuring of police wages and benefits, but it was distorted to appear as though it was taking away benefits. And that sort of sparked and the protest and was used to, you know, amplify a negative and violent reaction. I mean, imagine several hundred police with all their weapons out in the streets protesting and taking over installations, government installations. I mean, it was pretty scary. But what many don't know, who don't follow, you know, what's been taking place in Ecuador since, well, for many years, but particularly since Rafael Correa came to power 3 years ago, is the fact that there have been preparations underway now for several months to try to destabilize his government. And they're from different factions, political factions in the country on the far right as well as on the far left. So there have been protests over the past few months that have also been calling for his resignation before and trying to, you know, shut down the country. All these different factions use this excuse of the police reaction that was, you know, egged on to this law to then set into place the pieces that would eventually evolve into the coup. And there were, as the day progressed and the police became more violent, people began to take to the streets to defend Correa and rally around, you know, the president. The president went out there and tried to negotiate. And some say that maybe was an error, but that's who he is. And his negotiation was, you know, unsuccessful. And what ended up happening was he was sequestered. He was attacked by the police, physically assaulted and almost killed. There are now recordings that have come out since then of the police radios, the patrol radios, at the time when the president was out there trying to negotiate that with the officers, and they were actually calling out to kill him and his cabinet members that were with him. And then several different political groups began to issue declarations and statements calling for the president's resignation and a dissolution of not just his government, but also their Congress. And, I mean, that's what a coup is.
Ava, what was the role of U.S. Ambassador to Ecuador, Heather Hodges? You've written about her involvement with some of these organizations that issued declarations really pushing the idea of a coup forward during this turmoil.
Yeah, Heather Hodges, Ambassador Hodges, is a Bush appointee from 2008. And before that, she was ambassador in Moldova, which is another country that of the former Soviet bloc that is still socialist and has a strong communist party. And they tried to provoke what's called these colored revolutions, like the ones that took place in Ukraine and Georgia and Serbia, Yugoslavia, you know, trying to bring together internal factions. Basically, it's kind of like a soft coup d'etat where so-called civil society eventually provoke regime change, but do it through allegedly legitimate means. So, I mean, yeah, she's a Bushy and is still there. And since she's been in Ecuador, has actually increased the funding for U.S. agencies such as USAID and National Endowment for Democracy. I mean, we don't have any substantial, solid, direct evidence of like a smoking gun linking the U.S. ambassador to this particular coup. There's just a pattern of evidence that shows, you know, funding and support coming out of the U.S. embassy for political groups that oppose the government of Rafael Correa. And she's really been the ambassador in power since he's been in power. And it's also important to point out that President Correa was reelected last year in 2009 under the country's new constitution, which was ratified by popular referendum, national referendum in 2008. And he won with 55% of the vote. And polls, even before the coup took place, showed his popularity at over 70%. I mean, he's a very popular figure. And that's part of the reason why the coup didn't work.
Given this pattern of funding, U.S. and other outside funding that is being used or has been used to foment coup d'etats in Latin American nations, have Latin countries come together to try and come to some agreement where they can forestall future efforts like we saw in Ecuador and other countries before?
Well, the South American Union of Nations, UNASUR, did issue a very strong statement about what their reaction would be to a future coup if it took place in the region, and that, you know, imposing sanctions and closing off borders and refusing to recognize the government. But it always seems to be a dangerous time and for Latin American democracy because of the constant intervention from abroad. And I think what countries really need to do is follow the example of Bolivia and Evo Morales, who has ousted U.S. aid and other U.S. agencies that have been funding destabilization in Bolivia during his presidency, and that he's expelled them. They're out because they've been busted engaging in, you know, efforts to undermine his government. And I think that that's really what, you know, nations need to do is unify around a collective policy of not permitting this kind of interference and meddling in internal affairs that undermines democracy.
That was Venezuelan American attorney Eva Golinger, author of the book The Chavez Code and winner of Mexico's 2009 International Award for Journalism. Visit the website of the weekly newspaper she edits at correodelorinoco.gob.ve. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.